Welcome to Season 9, Episode 9 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk with Michael Ross about Acadacon. We also take the weed whacker to killer plants. Again, welcome to Season 9, Episode 9 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this week is Chris, Paul, and, of course, our guest, Michael Ross. Welcome, gentlemen.
Please be here.
Hello.
Well, after a little bit of a rough patch, we have finally started recording there, folks. I know you're like, what the hell are you talking about? Don't worry about it. It's just all fun stuff. It's the fun... I don't know. Anytime I ever have a guest, it seems like we have problems. So, at least it was at the beginning of the episode, not the end.
True.
So yeah. Why don't we just... There was a note here that International Tabletop Day was on April 29th. Unfortunately, that has passed.
Yeah, one of those elusive holidays, or holidays you don't find out until after the fact, but yeah. That's part of the...
I've never heard of it before. Have you guys?
Oh, me neither, man. I found out like on Sunday. I was going, okay, we need news. That's news.
It's big in the board gaming community.
That explains a lot.
So they do a lot of epic marathon sessions, 24 hours long, that kind of stuff, and fundraising and stuff like that. So it's big in the board gaming area. You don't see as much of it for the RPG stuff. That's more around the RPG free RPG day.
Okay. Oh, I guess I can see that. I don't know. All right, well, gentlemen, let us welcome Michael Ross. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you guys very much for having me. As we kind of talked in the pre-show, you had invited me on a few months ago, and at literally the last minute I had to cancel. I felt awful about that. So I appreciate the fact that you're willing to have me back on now. Thanks.
Oh, no worries. You know, if anyone has listened to this podcast long enough, they know my life is full of unexpected things happening. So I don't ever hold that against anybody.
Well, good, because I did feel really bad, but I would not have been a very good guest if I'd been here. I got very sick very quickly, so it's just best for everyone involved that I wasn't there that night.
Fair enough.
It's a good thing, then.
But, yeah, so we're having you on because, obviously, you have some stuff going on.
You talked about the Kickstarter for the convention. I don't know if it was your very last show or it was one of the last couple.
It was probably the last show. We record every 2 weeks. So.
Okay. All right. And you just, wanted to, I guess, ask me on to talk about some things to hopefully try to pronounce it well or better or different.
Yeah.
A running joke with us.
Let us have the official pronunciation.
So it's Acadacon. Our podcast is called the RPG Academy, so it's a play on academy and convention put together, but literally no one gets it right. It's not your fault. It's ours. It's a terrible name, but we're stuck with it.
And that's your official tagline for it, right?
Exactly. Yep. Terrible name, but we're stuck with it. Acadacon 2017.
Yeah.
So how many years have you been doing this?
We say it's our fifth year, but it's actually our fourth because we did the first two in the same year. We did it in February, the first time ever, and we knew we wanted to do it again, but we actually ran into some weather issues. I'm in southern Ohio, so we decided to move it, which is weird, but we moved it to November because it was better weather than February, which, who knows, the weather changes here pretty drastically all the time, but it's worked out fairly well. So the first year was February and then again in November. Since then it's been in November every year, so this is our fifth time. And D&D is my favorite game. I play a lot of role-playing games now, but I love D&D, so we kind of jokingly called it 2017 fifth edition because it's our fifth year and to kind of play on D&D.
So is fifth edition your favorite edition now?
Yes it is.
I only asked.
I played every edition but OD&D, and I do really like it.
Okay. No, I mean, I've never done fourth. I looked at the rules and decided it just was not for me. I'm actually currently playing a fifth edition game with some people I know, and I think I've played so much Savage Worlds. Sometimes I'm just like, I don't like this. And I think we all get that way with no matter what games we're playing. It's like, oh well, that's good. I like that, and then you're just like, crap, I just wish I could do this. This would be so much easier in a different system. I don't know. You ever get like that?
No, absolutely. And I've talked about that some on our show, that I play a bastardized version of D&D anyways. I've brought in elements of Fate, of Savage Worlds, of 13th Age, and just crazy stuff I make up on the fly. So it's not really recognizable as D&D a lot of ways, because I've brought all these other elements from other games that I like into them. But as just a basic rule set, particularly for newer players, I think 5th edition does a lot right. And what it doesn't do well, I can easily just ignore.
You know what, though? I would say that is more true to the spirit of D&D the way I played it back when I started.
House ruling is a way of life.
Absolutely.
So,
again, that's part of the fun when it comes to this sort of thing here. Well, I guess we could ask you the basic things. How did it ultimately begin, the convention? Like, when do you guys get together, like have a beer or something and just sort of set it up? Like,
Well, not exactly. I've been playing D&D now for about 30 years. As best I can remember, I started when I was around 12, and I'll be 42 this year. So right around 30 years for me. And I've always played with, like, my friends, my house, my basement. This was in the 80s. There's a lot of gamer shame, satanic panic. You know, up until like five, 6 years ago, I would lie to people at work about what I was doing. If I was going to have a game night and someone kind of noticed I was talking about this, I'd be like, what are you doing? I'm playing poker or Monopoly or something. And it wasn't until we started our podcast that I kind of realized that there was this community out there. And I live in close to Cincinnati. I'm like 2 hours away from Indianapolis. And it was because of the podcast that I went to Gen Con for that first year. And this was, I mean, it was truly a life-changing moment for me. I went from someone who had never gone to any convention ever, and now I go to as literally as many as I can possibly do, and I started my own. So it was at the end of that first Gen Con, we were driving home, and it was my buddy Travis. He was in the front seat, everybody else was conked in the back of the car asleep. And I'm just like, I can't wait a year to do this. Like, I literally cannot wait a year to do this again. We have to do something. Now, a smart person would have went home and Googled and found out that there's like 400 local conventions that are within like a 2-hour drive. I am not a smart person. So instead, I decided to make my own.
And thus it begins.
And thus it begins. Absolutely. So, yes, it was just that car ride home. I was on the high. I had so much fun. It was truly a life-changing moment for me. And I wanted to recreate that as best I could. And that's where it started.
Okay. Well, so how did you decide where to host it and all that? Kind of some of the logistical issues, the nitty gritty, so to speak.
So the first one that we did, you know, obviously, not surprisingly, it was basically just my friends. Like, it was like our normal gaming group, but we just made a weekend out of it. So I kicked the wife out of the house to take the kids, go to a hotel, and we just went down to the basement and played games for like 72 hours, sleeping in chairs and stuff.
Basement cons are awesome.
it was great. It wasn't necessarily Gen Con part two, but it was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed it. We knew we wanted to do it again. And this was about the time that our podcast started to gain a little bit of ground. So we started getting some people interacting with us on Twitter and emailing us and that kind of thing. So we just almost jokingly kind of threw it out and said, hey, we're going to do a Catacon again. It's going to be at my house. If we have anybody, you know, listening that wants to come hang out with us, go for it. And by granny, people showed up. We had a couple people flew in from Arizona to hang out in my basement. And no one got killed by an axe murderer, so that was good. So basically everybody just crashed at my house, you know, sleeping on couches, sleeping again in the basement. And it was awesome. There's a local game designer that I kind of ran into through the podcast. He came out and demoed a game he was working on. We had a couple people donate prizes. So we had like door prizes. So it was more like a real convention, but it was still basically a aggrandized gamers weekend. And it's actually Eric. He's the one that I credit and curse for this. He said, you know, if you do this again, why don't we like rent out a place? Like, you know, everybody just throw in $50. We'll rent out like a hotel ballroom. That way we got room to spread out. We don't have to, you know, displace my wife and my kids. I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. But instead of doing that, I decided to form a company and go on Kickstarter and actually create an actual event. And that was the first official Catacon where we raised about $4,000, rented out a ballroom at a hotel, rented rooms, had vendors. Well, it did actually have vendors. We had a bunch of, we were supposed to have one, but he ended up canceling because his store went out of business. But that's a long story. But it was like the first real Catacon was that year we went to the Houston Woods Lodge.
Sounds intriguing.
Yeah, it was a great location, but it was tiny. It was out in the middle of nowhere. There were vultures, like actual vultures everywhere.
And as in the birds?
Yeah, as in animals that carry in birds that would have eaten us if we had fallen in the woods.
That sounds awesome.
It had a great ambiance, but it was just too small, and it was literally out in the middle of nowhere. And the only reason we went there, we got a super great deal. Like, November is not a big time for a lot of, like, other things. So we got rooms cheap. We got the ballroom area cheap. But we had enough people showed up. At that point, we actually had people who'd never heard of us. They didn't know we were a podcast. They didn't know who we were. But they just heard there was a convention in the area, and people showed up. And I had a lot of people tell me, you know, this was a lot of fun. This was a great little con. I will definitely come back. So that kind of emboldened me to, like, okay, well, let's see what we can do with this. So the next year we went on Kickstarter again. We raised close to $9,000 that year. And we went to like an actual convention center. It's in Dayton, Ohio, which is like about 45 minutes from where I live, but they gave us the best deal on the room. And yeah, we had close to 330 people show up to that one. And that when we did actually have vendors show up, and we had a couple game designers. Rich Baker was there. Rob Schwab was there. A bunch of other podcasters that I'm friendly with that are kind of close, like the DM's Block guys. One Shot was there. And it was, again, it was just an amazing experience. So we decided, well, screw it. Let's do it again. And right now we're back on Kickstarter. This year we're trying to raise $10,000 and go a little bigger.
So that actually brings an interesting question. Do you think Kickstarter is kind of the way that most of the cons are going? Because I've noticed I've been reporting a lot on that.
Yes and no. We don't want to use Kickstarter. Like, it's our goal to stop at some point, because there are definitely pluses and minuses to it. And I think, especially for like a small con like what we still are, it's a security blanket, because we know that if we don't get to our funding, we're not out of any money yet. Like, we haven't paid any deposits. I've spent a couple $100 on some like Facebook ads, and we bought some flyers and stuff, but nothing that's going to break the bank. It's not like I put, you know, a $8,000 deposit on my credit card for the DCC, for the convention center, and then we don't have it.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a security blanket for that, but it also comes with its own negatives. They take 5%. The payment processing takes 5%. If you don't get there, you get nothing. So like right now we haven't got our funding yet. If we don't manage to get to $10,000 by, you know, May 16th, then we literally get nothing, and we have to start back over and, you know, kind of review our process. Like, do we ask for too much? Do we ask for it too early? You know, do we need to try to shrink down a little bit? You know, it's just going to cost so much work. But Kickstarter gives you an avenue to a platform that you wouldn't have otherwise. We have no marketing budget. You know, we have our podcast, which does pretty well, but we have people that listen, you know, all across the country. Those people aren't, other than a few crazy people, aren't going to come all the way from California to Ohio for a convention in November. So we don't really have a good draw of the people that are close enough to drive in for the day. So we got to have money for marketing, and Kickstarter kind of helps you do that. But eventually we want to get away from it.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm only asking because, like, for example, here in Phoenix, there's the Maricopa Con, and anytime I've ever seen them, they just do Kickstarters. And it's weird because, at least for them, I've never figured out how to, if you didn't back the Kickstarter, how to actually pay to go.
And that's the thing. Again, if you don't have a payment processing, you know, website or system yourself, that is one of the things that Kickstarter does for you. Excuse me. Hopefully you can edit that out. So that gives you the ability to take payment, which a lot of people don't have otherwise. And when we did ours, we based ours off of other conventions that did the same thing. You know, Fear the Boot Con was one that we looked at, the Tsunami Con, Lexicon is down here, and they're actually doing one called Sin City Con now. So there were templates out there, and we basically just kind of copied what they did. But for us, we use Eventbrite, which is just an online ticket agent. After the Kickstarter closes, people will be able to buy tickets and badges or whatever right up until the day of the event, and then we just got a little Square reader for $10 and get the free app, and we can sell tickets at the door. We sold raffle tickets last year. You know, we're going to sell. We have a few merchandise things that we're going to try to get this year to sell. So there are avenues if you just do some research.
Yeah. Okay, sounds good to me. Well, now it's story time.
Okay.
So you've been doing it for quite a few years. What would you say would be the highest, well, your favorite high point of your conventions over the last 5 or so years?
So anyone who listens to our podcast for a while knows I'm the type of person that enjoys, I'm the always DM. I enjoy presenting things and having players interact with them. So to be able to kind of sit back and watch a room full of people playing games that happened because I organized it or I had a part of organizing it, it hits a lot of buttons for me. And there's definitely a lot of joy and satisfaction that I get from that. But if I were to pick one moment that was my favorite, it was last year. Keith Baker, who I'm a fan of his forever. I love Eberron. I think it is my favorite. I won't say it's the best. It's my favorite setting for D&D. And Rich Baker, who's, if you pick a D&D book off the shelf, there's a good chance his name is in it. I got to play a game with Rich and Keith at the same time, just hanging out. We were, you know, I don't drink alcohol, but they were drinking some beers. I was drinking a Coke, and we were playing a game that Keith is working on. It was just like amazing. Like I have a picture of it, and I like say, no matter whatever else happens, I have that moment that I will never forget.
Oh, that sounds like freaking awesome. Yeah, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall for that one. Unfortunately, now comes the other fun question. What would you say would be the biggest challenge you've had over the last 5 years?
Organization. Because we don't have a structure in place. It's, you know, we do a podcast, much like you guys. You know, I'm friends with the people I do a podcast with, but a lot of them don't live near me. My co-host lives 5 hours away. The couple of the guys that we play most of our online games with, one's in New York, one was in Idaho, now he's in Maryland, and he's moving to California in a couple weeks. So because I'm the only one who's actually local, a lot of the organization actually kind of falls on my shoulders. I already have a full-time job, got a wife, I got two kids. I run a podcast, and you guys know that's like 20 hours a week. So then to add on top of that, calling all the game stores, trying to get vendors, trying to get people to donate, you know, stuff, organizing the Kickstarter. And I'm not going to say I do all of it. That's not what I'm saying. But I do a lot of it. And as we've grown, you know, trying to keep up with that and making sure that people have a good time. And, you know, I got some anxiety from that because just like the awesome thing is that people are willing to fly across the country to come to my convention, that makes me happy. But if they fly from California and they have a crappy time, that's on me. So that anxiety of making sure that we fulfill the promise that we make, that if you come to our convention, you'll have a good time.
That makes very much sense to me. Like, ultimately, when you're dealing with anything that's, you know, requires managerial skills, there's always going to be a lot of pressure on you, especially with the point of command, you know, pin of command.
Yeah, and, you know, I've been a manager in my real life for quite a while, but I've always been a manager in a job that I know very well, so I could delegate because I would know how to follow up with people and be like, hey, I did that for 4 years. I can help you if you struggle, but this is all new to everybody, so I can't really delegate because I don't know what anyone should be doing either, so I really did not delegate at all last year, and it just about killed me. So hopefully this year, we are a little bit bigger, but we're in the same place. It's the same general setup. I'm hoping that I'll be able to delegate a little bit more to people and have a little bit more of a comfort level. Because, again, it's on me. I'm kind of that A-type personality. I don't want to delegate. I want to control everything. But for my own sanity and health, I need to. Because we want this to continue to grow. We want it to get bigger. And eventually, it will not be something that I can do this much work for. It just wouldn't work.
No, I can see that. What are your ultimate goals for a Catacon anyway? Like, what's your plan other than just making a really awesome convention? Like, where do you see it in, like, say, 5 years or so?
If you would have asked me that last year, I think I would have had a different answer. Because as it started to grow, you know, we thought, is this something that we could turn into a business? Like, could we just work on a convention all year? We could podcast and then, you know, present a thing that enough people cared about, enough people came to, that we could make enough money that would be our job. And even though we are still being successful, I don't know that that's feasible anymore. So I'm trying to kind of take a step back from that being a goal and just say, just whatever happens, happens. As long as I'm still having fun putting it on, as long as people are still having fun showing up, I'm not going to be so focused on it being like a money-making thing. So, you know, I think our goal this year is 500 people. If we get 400, that's great. If we get 600, that's great. I'm not going to focus on that aspect and just try to make the best event I can. And if it does grow to that point, that's just bonus.
You know what that sounds like a lot to me is where I was with this podcast, I think, in the first year or two. I mean, not that I had any delusions of making any real money on the podcast, but I was thinking, oh, you know, it'd be nice to get some, you know, have some, you know, get some sort of sponsorship, get some sort of money to buy nice equipment, maybe have some, you know, something like that. And eventually I'm just like, you know what? I'm doing this for fun. I want to enjoy this. I want people to enjoy the podcast. I don't, anything that happens, happens.
Right.
So
I went through the same thing with the podcast as well. They very much mirror each other.
Yeah.
That we had enough success to make me think, and then it's like, oh, reality set in.
Yeah. Pesky reality. By the game.
All right. Well, okay. I guess here's an interesting question. Outside of your own convention, what's your favorite convention then? You said you go to a lot of them.
So my favorite still would be Gen Con. You know, again, much like D&D was my first game. And I love it, even if there's other games out there that might actually be better fits for the type of games that I run. D&D is my favorite. That's my first love, and I will always love it the most. Gen Con was my first convention. There is nothing else like it in the world that I've ever been to. So it's probably my favorite convention.
I would probably say a while ago that might have been my answer. But the last time I went to Gen Con, I felt it got too large for me.
Yeah, and I've heard people that have been there longer have said that. You know, again, I think this will be my fourth year. So I kind of came in. It was already at like 50,000 people.
Yeah.
So now that it's at 60, it's not that big of a difference versus someone who may have been there when it was like 5,000 people. You know,
I wasn't there at 5,000. I thought they had more than 60,000 last year. I thought they had closer to 80.
Maybe. I think there's like a 50, then like a 68. Maybe last year was 80. It was a lot of people. Yeah, but I don't know. It just, maybe, I guess because I don't have that comparison,
yeah.
that doesn't seem to bother me. And I don't know. It just,
well,
go ahead.
So the unique attendance was 60,000 in 2016. Okay. Yeah. But it's so weird. I think also for me, and I think mine was a lot lower. I think mine was like maybe in the 30,000s, one of the first ones that I went to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, that's double. That's still a huge difference.
Yeah. And I think for me, the other thing, too, was there were, I think the first year that I went, the RPG bloggers were really going, you know, I don't know if you ever, you know who those were. There was like an organization of different RPG blogs that would be part of this. It was like the RPG blogger site was like a concatenation feed that you could do for all the RSS feeds.
Ah, gotcha.
And so it was like basically just a loose confederation, but all these people at that time, they were talking on Twitter and a whole bunch of other things, and they're like, hey, you know, why don't we have a meetup there? So everyone was, they were like, we're all going to the con anyway. Why don't we just have a little meetup while we're there? And so that actually happened. And for me, that was the best part of the convention. Was like, hey, I get to meet people that, you know, I blog with, that I do podcasts, you know, that do some of the same things that I do. And it was like, so it was almost like a meetup at the convention with it. It was almost like a mini convention within the convention in a way.
Sure, yeah.
For that. And so it was nice meeting those people. And, you know, I got to meet, I think that was the year that I met Michael Wolf from Stargazer's World. And, of course, the guy that I was podcasting with at the time, he actually had us stay at his place.
Oh, nice.
which was nice. So there was just a lot going on. And for me, that was the more memorable part of the convention. I've gone back and it's just like, you know, there's people that I know. I mean, I meet them every once in a while, but they weren't quite doing the meetups. There wasn't a lot of, I don't know, it was weird. It was almost like I didn't get to do as much gaming at Gen Con as I always hoped. And it's like you try to plan and it just never, I don't know, it just didn't work out. And then eventually I'm just right. Like, I'm coming here for what? And I'd rather go to a much smaller convention and game and enjoy myself again. That was just me.
Yeah, and I completely understand that. And that's very likely that might eventually happen to me as well. with Gen Con. I mentioned, you know, the secret origin to a Catacon was that drive home from Gen Con. But it actually started a little earlier than that, because we did sort of the same thing. We did a meetup. So all the people from the podcast that went, and then we threw it out again on the podcast, hey, we're going to do this thing. And we had like five or six people show up. It was not a big thing. But that was probably my favorite event at that first Gen Con, was actually at our hotel the night before Gen Con, just playing games with those guys. You know, guys and girls, there's a bunch of people showed up. We played, you know, to like 3 o'clock in the morning or something stupid. And, you know, I have a picture of all of us there together at the end of one of the games. And I was like, that's probably where it really started. And that's become a tradition. Every year now I do a pre thing on Wednesday night, because there's not a lot of actual gaming going on. So Wednesday night I get a room and we just play games until people pass out.
You can actually get a room to Gen Con?
Well, the room itself, we lucked out. One of our good friends is a VIP every year, and they get two rooms. So he always gifts us his, well, obviously we pay for it. We pay him back, but we are pretty much always guaranteed a room close.
No, I joke, because that's one of the biggest complaints I think that people have for Gen Con is the housing service just sucks.
Oh, no, I completely agree. If it wasn't for this, you know, blessed situation I'm in, I would probably be breaking pencils and pulling my hair out.
Because I remember me and Zach, we actually, with some of his buddies, we actually had a hotel pool where we were putting in money to have a hotel room. And I think we couldn't get a room. I mean, it was actually the housing service was out, like within like, it was ridiculous, like 24 hours, 36 hours, something like that. It was done. And I don't even know what it was.
Now there's a lottery, and like some people don't even get a chance to try for the hotel.
Yeah.
The one of my good friends who does Airbnb every year, he says it's cheaper, it's easier. They just do an Airbnb and get like seven people, split the cost, and you know, that's his secret. So if my hotel hookup ever falls apart, that's probably what I'll do. But yeah, if anyone, you listening or anyone listening in your audience, is coming to Gen Con Wednesday night, 5 o'clock, over at the Crown Plaza or the Union Station, sorry, there's like a mezzanine, and that's where we'll be.
The Union Station. God, I can't remember which one that is.
It's where the innies are held. They have that huge like stained glass window. It used to be a train station.
Okay. Yeah. Which one is it that has the weird statues of people?
Oh.
There's actually some of the hotel rooms are in rail cars.
That's actually the Crown Plaza, I think. It's like attached. There's a walkway between those, but yeah, I want to play Deadlands in one of those trains.
Yeah. Those statues to me after a while get a little creepy. No, they do. They're supposed to be statues of people like waiting for trains or whatever, or train passengers, and they're just like, yeah, that's interesting, but it gets a little creepy looking at them or something. They creep me out in some weird way. You know, it's like if someone actually was like, I'm going to play a trick on these people at Gen Con, you know, that would be it, to be dressed like a statue, be like posed, and then just like frighten someone, the shit out of someone. Cause I think most people are creeped out by their statues.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well,
I'm going to get hate mail now. Someone, that was a great idea, and someone did it, you son of a bitch.
Well, hey, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, I guess.
That's okay. Anywho, you also do a podcast, remember, to serve me correctly, and I've been listening to it so regularly, and I've really enjoyed it. I particularly liked your trials, particularly the one involving the Ghostbusters and that relatively recent one where you did RuneQuest with ducks.
Yes.
And, yeah, you guys are a riot there. So,
it's kind of funny. That RuneQuest episode has been one of our most downloaded episodes, but we've kind of got a lot, not only hate mail, because it's been good natured, but a lot of people were a little bit offended because we didn't treat those ducks with the seriousness it deserved.
Dude, like, you're playing Donald or Darkwing.
But apparently we weren't. Like, that's what we thought. We all went into it thinking we're basically Huey, Louie, and Dewey. And apparently, no. Like, there's this you know, poignancy to these ducks, because they're like this culture that is being subjugated by these other people. And, like there's a whole level of role play that we were supposed to have, and none of us knew anything about that. So we were playing ducks. I mean, it was...
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to be able to hold the duck angst very long.
See, that's interesting, because it's like, even I didn't know that. I've played some RuneQuest, and, you know, I always knew the ducks were a race, but it's like, I don't think I got that out of anything. So, obviously, I'm not that knee deep in that stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, the trials are absolutely one of my favorite things that we do. We play different systems, things that we haven't played before, and we always try to get someone who's really good at the system to run it for us so that we represent it well, and then also because I don't want to try to learn a new system every week. We've been really lucky. We've got some game designers to actually, trying to think of the last one that we did. The actual game designer did it. I can't remember right now, but we had a couple that the game designers themselves ran it. That's something we try to do. Obviously, with the way the world is right now, a lot of those are Kickstarters. So it's a game that's being Kickstarted or was just Kickstarted or is about to be Kickstarted. But it's still a lot of fun. I really enjoy it.
Okay. Well, I hate to say it, but, we're going to have to go to our next segment. So is there any last comments you'd like to make?
Just if anyone else listening that hasn't listened to our podcast yet, please, give it a listen. TheRPGAcademy.com. We do a ton of different types of shows. I won't go through them, but we do a little bit of everything. So if you like any of it, you might like all of it. If you don't like some of it, you might like the other parts. And if you're anywhere near Dayton, Ohio, or going to be near Dayton, Ohio in November, please check out our Kickstarter. We still, again, we're right at 80%. I think we're like 79.9% right now. We got another 2 weeks left to get to 100%. And we'd appreciate the support. And, again, I will do everything in my power to make sure you have a great time while you're there.
All right. Well, good luck with that. I hope you hit your Kickstarter.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you guys, and appreciate you guys having me on. Thank you so much.
Oh, no. My pleasure. All right, we are now going to continue to our second topic, which is killer plants. And there is a shitload of material for this.
Yeah, I kind of went a little crazy on the note-taking here.
Yeah, you're... you at least covered my personal favorite, which is, of course, Gamma World.
Yeah, Gamma World.
Well,
sentient plants.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, the reason I brought it up is because I like to do gaming topics related to holidays, particularly silly holidays. Last Friday was Arbor Day, so
I thought, I didn't know that. I passed on that, obviously.
Okay, so I thought, okay, what the heck? What could be related here? And I said, okay, we did another monster spotlight. We'll do killer plants. And ultimately, I'm trying to cover multiple genres here because when it comes to plants... killer plants specifically, one of the reasons why they're such effective as a concept is they are alien. It's unexpected because plants don't normally move at normal speed. It's also unexpected because plants don't generally eat people or anything. It's also the idea of a change of relationship because normally you eat the plant, it doesn't eat you, as well as idea of a repellent or as a guardian of some sort, which is commonly used in various different games and genres here. Often fungoid is folded into plants for purposes of critters, in spite of technically being closely related to animals because they have a lot of the same characteristics and stuff. Now, even though there's no actual man-eating plants that we know of, fortunately, there are at least three key real-life examples, which are the for carnivorous plants, the pitcher plant, the sundew, and the Vetus flytrap. And often, fictional monsters, killer plants, are based on either one of the three. Mm-hmm. Those are the basics as far as the overall generality. So, what are your favorite killer plants from, say, gaming? Have you ever used them?
Well, definitely, like I said, Gamma World. I think I've used them mostly in Gamma World.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like, you almost can't. I mean, Gamma World, at least in every edition I've ever played in, it's like, plant. Here's plants, and here are the plant mutations. I mean, even the first edition, which I have, by the way, it's like plants were their own thing, and they had their own set of plant mutations. So it's like, you almost can't get away from, I think Gamma World is probably the linchpin in killer plants in terms of usage.
Well, I'd argue it's probably one of the first when it comes to the gaming perspective because of all the crazy stuff that came out of it. Like, my personal favorite of the Gamma World plants has got to be the burlip, which essentially is what happens when you make a lily pad of Venus flytrap. So it's sort of floating around in the water and then basically takes a bite at a crime. But they got all sorts of crazy stuff. And often they're usually based on, I'm one of these people that steals horribly from nature and then tries to find a logical extension of this, and apparently I wasn't the only one because a lot of these creatures are based on, science facts, especially in the Gamma World environment. They take it and they just sort of extrapolate it to its logical extreme. Stuff like poison ivy, which really will poison you, or bindweed, or caribou lichen, or the giant corpse flower, which I can't remember, but I sure is ominous.
Well, that's actually a real world thing, but it's not a killer plant, though.
Yeah. But again, it's always fun to... Yeah, basically... Okay. I am near the Matar Conservatory, which is essentially a giant glass pyramid in the city of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And they have one of those giant corpse flowers that just bloomed as of 2 days ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and trust me, you don't want to smell it. There's a reason they call it corpse flower here. Basically, it blooms every 3 years, so that's always a lot. You know, just a bit of food for thought. But what I thought I got a real kick out of is when I was doing my research, I did not realize that in the first edition, there literally was a random table for if you wanted to play a plat mutant. They actually had it so you could roll up your own little random plant, much like you could with an animal or just a more generic type mutant. So if you ever wanted to play
In some versions, those were taken out, but I think more recent versions, they've been put back in.
Which was?
The ability to be a plant.
Yeah. Well, again, it's a fun concept as far as the stuff's concerned. In order to, well, basically play a life form that's really alien. Like, if the more weirder the plant uses a creature you use as a base, the more alien it becomes. And a plant is probably one of the most alien things that we actually have in common every day because it just sort of stands there. It doesn't do anything. Yet, paradoxically, the largest creature on the planet right now is a redwood. A giant tree. Think about that.
Yeah.
You know, and then we go into, well, Darwin's Ward really doesn't have a lot there, but I've had the desert enemies and plants. But of course, we got to talk about Dungeons and Dragons, which almost as bad as Gamma World when it comes to plant monsters. Like, I always talk fondly about the Expedition of the Barrier Peaks, which brought to, you know, one of the most potentially racially offensive creatures in the world, but that being said, they're funny as hell. Veggie pygmies. You know, those little critters that run all over the place. They're about half your size. They're basically fungoid creations. They're created from Russell Mold. So, yet again, crossing the thing there. Or something like Trents, which are literally out of Lord of the Rings for all intents and purposes. They just renamed them for copyright purposes.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
The serial numbers are filed off.
Exactly. Or one of my personal favorites, the wolves in sheep's clothing, which essentially was a bunny on a stump, but the stump was basically a giant monster.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you have one of my favorites, the Shambling Mound.
Yeah, I've used the Shambling Mound before.
Yeah. And again, it's a fun creature, especially when you try to use a lightning bolt in the damn thing and find out you shouldn't have. You know, and one of my favorites actually comes from a later edition. It's called the Orc Wart, where basically it's a tree that generates plant orcs, for lack of a better term. And basically acts as a giant carnivore, which uses itself to feed the thing. So it's kind of fun. And of course, there's the Fiend Folio Yellow Musk Creeper, which created the first plant zombie that I know. And what's particularly interesting is there actually is an evil plant god in the Forgotten Realms called Moander. In fact, I did a lot of research on this when I did Swords of the Lost Veil for GM's Guild, because it was in the original Finer Stone trilogy, it was a giant mountain of corrupt, you know, rotting plants. So basically you're fighting a evil hill for all intents and purposes here in the fiction. So, you know, minor deity, but still. And one of the things you would do in order to show its corruption is it would stick a tendril into your head of anybody who is possessed, kind of like Willow Musk creature, but on a larger scale. And of course, you know, talking back to when we were talking about Fae, some could argue that the Dryad could be an example of a Fae version of a plant person or a plant tender. In order to get there. So, you know, it's kind of fun. As well as various magical plants. Like, if you go into the Forgotten Realms, you're going to find magical plants of some sort. And I'm providing a link there because, honestly, if you need help building a plant, when it comes to some of these creatures, it's not that hard to basically say, okay, how can I make this do horrible, horrible things? It's really not that hard. Then we get into my old fetish, Rifts. Which I would argue the single most prominent killer plant is actually relatively benevolent. Have anybody here heard of a millennial tree?
No.
Okay. Originally introduced in Rifts, England, essentially it was a tree about the size of a mountain that had pods in it that you had entire civilizations and lives living in there. And it usually was built on a ley line nexus where ley lines intersect of high magical energy, and it usually ended up as a tap. Now, it basically fed off the magical energy and was completely unaffected by the weather, thus it could bloom in, like, minus 40 weather. But if it considered you a friend, it would drop a branch, which would be essentially an artifact of some sort. You know, like, there was guys running around wearing leaves as ponchos, and of course they're MDC because, well, Rifts, let's be honest. And, you know, you've heard my opinion. Okay, going to other stuff like Cactus People, which you've heard, I've talked about in the past. Long story short, a really neat concept that could have been done a little better, but I kind of like the idea of sentient cactuses in the area here. There's also something known as a Ganka, which is actually from a relatively recent product, DBs of North America, which you're essentially playing an entire race of Audrey 2.
Nice.
So, you know, it was fun. It was kind of neat there. And all that comes with the other stuff here. Like, what's funny is a lot of my games ultimately end up having plants in some way, shape, or form. Like, when I did my second book for Dark Revelations, one of the things we found out when we were building it is most plants have a psychic component, which will explain why they can move around and stuff. And it's where we created the race known as Harvesters, which originally started as evil mind players, but ultimately became what happens when you cross mad scientists with Hutterites. And so you have these entire farmlands where they're creating essentially plant monsters for their own nefarious reasons. We also have something called the Damnation Eater, which essentially... Okay, who here remembers the old 60s Spider-Man cartoon?
The 60s one?
The 60s one.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, there's this really awesome one called Vines, where they go back in time and they have this huge, huge plant monster with a flower head that basically terrorizes the city. We took that and we crossed it with Bob the Angry Flower, and we basically made it a trans-dimensional plant monster that's about the size of an elephant, but it snakes around the ground with a giant flower on the front. We nicknamed it Bob based on a local cartoon called Bob the Angry Flower. And yes, you can probably watch it online. It's just as sarcastic as you think it is. So again, it's fun to just think of that stuff there. So now that we've done the basic dissertation, I got a few examples from common media. Do you guys have any as well? Have you used any plant monsters? Have you used them for any specific scenarios or created anything that might sound kind of neat?
I've used a shambling mound before, and I'm pretty sure in Gem World I've used a couple plants, but nothing really springs to mind that was really noteworthy. I do try to make sure that my players know what the local flora and fauna look like, so it gives them a better idea of where they're at. I guess I don't put a lot of agency into it, though, although this is certainly one way you could do that.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I mean, I haven't used anything recently, but one of the games I'm playing D&D in, the adventure had, like, some sort of shrubberies that were attacking people.
How I like it. Thing, I like crazy monsters.
You know, unfortunately, they weren't very tough.
So. Oh, no worries, man. They just need to do their job, and ultimately that's part of the fun. But I'm one of these people that maybe it's because I built so many monsters recently that... CR should determine difficulty so much as more than anything else when it comes to building a proper system. Like, if you're building it based on a level gauge, which means a CR 8 monster is a CR 8 monster. It doesn't matter what it is, but it should be fun depending on what you're doing it there. Like, if you're getting attacked by a CR 20 plant and a CR 20 dragon, it's still a CR 20 counter, and you should be wetting yourself. You know, and just part of the fun of the numbers here. But as for examples from media, I'm going to bring up some of my favorites ranging from the silly to the serious. Like, I've already mentioned Little Shop of Horrors, which is probably the iconic killer plant. Then again, there's always the 70s parody Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, which is always a lot of fun. There's the post-apocalyptic legend The Day of the Triffids, which the plants were only a secondary part of the monster problem. It was the fact that pretty much the entire population went blind was part of the problem here. Of course, Body Snatchers. What was it called again? Body Snatchers. I can't remember the full title.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
Thank you. Which literally, you're making plant clones of your characters. You know, they're capturing people, they're literally making plant clones that are using out in the other areas there. And of course, there's the one of my favorite video games, which is the Plants vs. Zombies franchise, where they have an active imagination when it comes to using plant monsters. Is more often than not, they're play on words of some sort. They're usually kind of cute, but when you think about it, it'd be really easy to extrapolate that from take a monster or two from there that you use as a self-defense system and then turn it into a monster. Like, everybody's going to laugh when you hear about a pea shooter until you realize it's shooting a 45 caliber pea.
Mm.
Or something to that effect. Or a thump. Or, you know, corncob missiles or something to that effect. Like, part of the fun is taking a concept and just sort of twisting it just enough to be interesting. So, do you have any ones from popular media that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I don't know if it's I mean, the only one that comes to mind is not, I don't necessarily think it's killer per se, but I'm thinking of like some of the old Star Trek episodes. Definitely had examples. Okay. You know, there was like one, it was like the original series comes to mind where, you know, had some sort of spores that shot out and everyone was kind of semi-brainwashed.
That's always fun. Oh, I remember that one.
Oh, and then, I was just thinking of a movie. Yeah. Peter Sellers. The Fiendish Plot of Dr. Fu Manchu. Where there was a scene where there was like some sort of plant or something that Fu Manchu set up to capture the queen because it like let out some sort of noxious gas that knocked everybody out.
Ooh, that's going to be fun. So, and of course, you want to expand it to, you know, spores and mushrooms. You could always go for the good old-fashioned shrieker.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about the shrieker.
Well, you also have you have kind of a twist on that with Evil Dead, in where the plants were possessed by the evil spirit that had been conjured there. So while the plants themselves weren't technically evil, weren't sentient, as it were, but they were being used by the evil spirit to commit horrible things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I remember Ash versus the Tree, the final part of Evil Dead 2.
Yep.
Yeah, one of those great classic scenes.
Piers Anthony's Xanth novels, a lot of which are based on puns, have a lot of flora that are extrapolations, like we said before, of like a pineapple bush or something like that that actually has grenades on it or something like that.
Okay.
So yeah, those are a couple that I can think of.
Yeah. And of course, there's always the classic Whomping Willow from Harry Potter.
Right.
Oh, like you crash your car and then of course it gets pissed off, and I'd be too. Let's be honest, I was just not minding my own business to get my car. You know.
And I mean, I've never read the Harry Potter books. I've seen the movies. Is that I can only imagine that that's kind of a one-off in that universe. I mean, I can't imagine that they're all over the place. It seemed rather deadly. I mean, it did actually kill within the film.
Yeah, it killed a car almost.
No, it killed a bird.
Oh, right.
It actually ate a bird or whatever it did. It did kill a bird.
Okay, well, I can see that. I can also see it would be incredibly dangerous because of it there. Like, I know it did a number on that car, and that was just like...
Right.
I think most iconic scenes, because they think they've landed, it's kind of a bad landing, but they can walk away and then suddenly the tree starts moving and they're terrified, and justifiably so. I guess unless there's anything else, I think that covers the basics here. Any other things you want to bring up with using killer plants in your game? Or
I'm trying to think here, because I mean, definitely, I think killer plants definitely in the realm of science fiction, especially, like exploration type science fiction, I could see where that could be really, mm-hmm. really big. But I mean, it always seems like, in many ways, they kind of fall into two categories, which is something that you end up breathing that kills you.
Yeah,
or something vine-like that causes strangulation. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff in between, but I mean, there's almost like the two classical, you know, no matter what you do, it's like there's always some sort of plant that does one or the other.
Yeah, I can see that. But again, it would be fun, like, when in doubt, do what I do. Look for some elusive plant fact and see if you can build an entire encounter around it. Because what if the plant itself is just simply a catalyst for, say, a bug or something. You know, if it gets near it and you're trying to pluck it, then suddenly it releases a gas in the air and suddenly bees attack you or something.
Well, and yeah, I mean, there's also, you know, the killer plants is like repellents. So the plant itself might repel most predators, but then the characters are, you know, for whatever reason, they're not affected by it. So as they get closer to it, they notice fewer and fewer signs of life except for other plants, and then, you know, they have this thing that attacks them because it drives away all of the predators, and the characters are just not smart enough to pick up on it.
Yeah, it could spray with, like, say, a chemical or some other dye or something. I like that. Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to think if there's any other weird examples that are, you know, even from gaming.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, well, there's also, I mean, if you have, like, you have the druid has a lot of plant control spells. And I mean, I think if you wanted to, with, you know, if you collaborated with your druid, the druid character, you could certainly produce some really interesting results when they tried to cast some of their spells. You know, like I think there's like an entangle where it catches everybody up. Well, if they cast that in, you know, maybe in a very temperate climate, it might be just standard vines. But if you're in the desert, it might be some kind of a thorny cactus that inflicts additional damage, or, you know, something like that. You could certainly work with a druid like that, especially their spells.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun there. I like that. Unless there's anything else to a thing, I think this topic is more or less done. Thanks, gentlemen.
I think so. I think we can actually kind of get into our Kickstarters, which we have moved towards the back because, well, we've had some requests for it. So, shall we get started?
Sure. Let's do it.
Sure.
First up, we have Cortex Prime, a multi-genre modular RPG game. This is, you know...
Is this the game that Marvel was based on? Yes, Marvel Heroic Role Playing. Yes.
So I mean, this is
Smallville. Yep.
Now they were asking; they already reached their goal.
Hooray!
Which is not bad, but the digital copy was $10 for the PDF, which is not too bad, and $25 for the soft cover. That's not too bad either. So that's actually a pretty good price. Especially,
it is. I mean, it is a completely generic system, so it, you know, it's just the rules. And to be fair, I played Smallville before, and the Cortex version that I played in there is actually quite clever. Especially if you're doing like a social game, it's really neat. In fact, I use it in almost every game I play now.
Okay. Yeah, and it looks like it was licensed out from Margaret West Productions by a different studio in order to try to get everything together here, because from what I understand, Margaret West is more or less retired now. So it's good to see that she's able to delegate some of the products here and still make, you know, as much money as you ever do make at gaming, to see if there's still interest in the system.
Yeah, I mean, for that price, it's not probably worth it. It's not that bad. I mean, like I said, $10 for the PDF, that it might be worth it for some people just to check it
out.
Yeah,
well, yeah.
Absolutely. Have you guys ever played Cortex? Because I sure as heck haven't.
You know, I have not. And a lot of it just has to be nothing that they've done really struck my fancy.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds weird. You're like, well, there was Smallville and there was Firefly. And it's like, yeah, I know. But on the other hand, I guess I don't mind playing licensed material, but I like more generic guy systems that I deal with myself.
No, I understand completely. Yeah. Like, so I was actually hanging on for one of my favorite settings of all time, Age of Apocalypse, that was supposed to be coming out of the year, and literally, it was the next product on the line. And then they canceled the license, so I'm saying, okay, I'm not buying it then.
So,
part of the fun.
So, next up, we have the 5th Edition Fighter Folio and Condition Cards, which, they still got 20 days to go. They're asking $4,000. I don't know. This is one of those ones that, since I don't really... I mean, 5th edition's okay in my book. Yeah. I don't know if I could spend money on this if I'm not really into playing 5th edition.
No, I can understand that completely here. The problem with, again, is you gotta vet third-party products to some degree just to make sure it's a quality thing here. It looks really good. Got great art, and I do like the idea. I don't know.
Yeah, the interesting thing is it's $15 for the PDF.
Yeah.
And then if you want the actual print on demand, it's $45.
Yeah, well, that's within reasonable rates as long as you have a decent local printer. You know, I'm not going to grow too hard. Mind you, I've heard that a lot of stuff gets printed in, like, Eastern Europe and gets shipped over here because ultimately it's cheaper.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. So
yeah, they got a way to go on that one, so.
Yeah.
We'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah, you know, if you want to sell the product, you got to try.
This one I actually thought was kind of an interesting Signal and Sign, Cthulhu Mythos RPG where you play the cultist.
Sweet.
Just from that tagline, that sounds interesting. I just don't know.
Well, they're to the way there. They got 5,000 pounds to go, but they got like 20 days. There's a good chance they'll make it.
No, oh, yeah, I think they'll make it. It's Cubicle 7. They've got the weight behind them.
Yeah, no, I mean it's not that. I'm thinking more along the lines of I don't know if I could play the cultist.
Well, there is that. I mean, you're talking about someone with a, you know, some serious deep character flaws, and I mean, again, I mean this kind of this all this stuff circles around Call of Cthulhu of, you know, why do I want to play a game where I'm doomed, from the word go.
Yeah,
I'm doomed.
Yeah, this is what you definitely need in episode zero to basically hammer out what you're going to do with it, because this game can go south really fast.
That's the other thing is that without, you know, even with a well-behaved group, you might find yourself kind of sitting back after three or four sessions. You're like, you know, maybe we should stop playing this.
Yeah.
Or maybe you just might sit back after three or four sessions like, this is, I mean, it could be very neat. Cubicle Stipend puts out a lot of really good product. You know, I wish them luck. I don't think it's for me, though.
$37 though for the conversion is $37 US for the digital core set, and it's almost $76 for the print version.
Yeah, that's pretty standard for Cubicle 7. They often charge an arm and a leg, but they in return you get a really high quality product.
No, I have no complaints about that on them. So
okay, so I guess if you're interested in the Cubicle 7 product and you want to play the bad guys or the insane guys, this product is for you,
I guess.
Yep.
So next up, we have a second edition for Eclipse Phase. I never played the original. Either one of you guys have?
I have. No. For a small story arc there. We totally avoided the thing. We ended up playing essentially a cop drama on Mars. So I've never actually had the full effect of Eclipse Phase, where basically an AI is taking over the planet, and you're basically screwed if you go down there. So it looks good. It looks fun. I've heard nothing but good things about the system. And, of course, it's our own cautionary tale of what might happen in 50 years from now. But I got a feeling 50 years from now, we might have the same effect as Cyberpunk. Where, hey, this feels like the future. Oh, wait, it's in the past now.
Yeah.
And so, it didn't happen.
So $20 for the base PDF version. $40 if you want the PDF and then any digital stretch goals. Right now... Yeah, I guess I don't even know where they are on their stretch goals. I kind of don't like...
They're probably well past any of them. They're way over their...
Yeah, their pledge levels are basically over 9,000.
Yeah, they have two...
And they're basically working towards 100,000 one where you're Whispering Muses.
Yeah. So...
Holy moly, they got some good chunk of change for this one. There must be a serious fan base.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The print copy is $60. This is what I don't like. If I'm paying $6, you should give me the electronic version as well. Instead, $75 for the PDF and print.
Ouch. Yeah.
Serious jack up in price.
Yeah, that's one thing I don't like. Is it's like, okay, I can understand a PDF-only version, but if I'm going to pay the money, you should give me the PDF as well.
Well, they did that for the digital stretch goals, too. A lot of things, like if you buy the PDF, you get all the digital stretch goals. Here... You don't get the digital stretch goals unless you kick in an extra $20.
Yeah. So that's a little weird, but you know, if you like the original Eclipse Phase, then it's probably something you're going to pack.
Yep.
And I mean, it's already funded, and it still has only.
Yeah.
A couple
in fact, of... if you throw money in there, you're not just getting the original product; you're getting a good chunk of the stretch goals. They're already listed on the thing. So if this is your game, this is your Kickstarter. Okay, what's next?
The Book of Contemporary Magical Things. A collection of modern items imbued with magical resonance for contemporary and urban RPGs. Kind of. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Well, again, it's the older concept of the fetish where you take an ordinary item and you make it extraordinary. So it's kind of fun. Some of the examples, like a tuning fork that'll quiet a room, a pair of cufflinks that'll tell you the name of family details of those whom you shake hands.
Yeah,
and
I
so
mean,
forth.
It,
so.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, this is kind. I mean, if you take it to the nth degree, of course, you have things like was it Warehouse 13? TV show?
Yes.
Sci-fi?
Yep.
You kind of get along with that kind of effect, I suppose.
Okay. Well, it sounds fun, and it might be fun for inspiration, that's for sure.
Yeah. So let's see.
Yeah, it's only $13 for the PDF, so.
That's not bad. See, this.
No.
Again, this is one of those things that, in a PDF format, makes a lot of sense. I don't know if I would ever get something like this in print.
Yep.
Does that make any sense?
That makes perfect sense for this.
Well, again, it's a 10-pound PDF. That's pretty pricey if I were to serve me correctly. My conversions are there, but still being said, you do that, you're not dealing with shipping. And it might be fun as a quick resource.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. As a resource, I would get the PDF, not buy a print copy.
Yeah, I can see that.
That's, you know, but I mean, that's kind of my rule as a whole with these type of things is like, for example, core rule books, I like to have a print copy, but a lot of the supplements, depending on what the supplement is, I like just doing the PDF only.
Okay. That'd be fun.
Yeah. All right, so here's an odd one. The Remarkable Inns and Their Drinks, the Ultimate GM's Guide.
I like it, but...
So, it's basically a book of famous taverns featuring ready-made inns and new gameplay for over 1,000 options to create your own. Okay. But I just like the idea. It's 80 pages.
And apparently a lot of other people did because they doubled their funding goal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this sounds like a fun coffee table book. You know, I guess you could find the equivalency online, but still, I could see this being a real blast with, you know, especially if they build the thing quirky enough in order to get things going.
Yeah. $10 for the PDF. I mean, I actually spent $11 US for the PDF, and then... about $27 US for the soft cover.
Well, has potential, that's for sure.
Yeah. I like the idea.
Well, the real test will be is how colorful are the ends, and I'm hoping they're very colorful. Otherwise, you know, you're buying a reference manual.
Yep. Here's one that I saw that I'm just like, well, this is kind of very specific, and I'm going to say esoteric in a way. The Quick, tabletop RPG of Nordic Noir Ghost Stories.
Okay, that could be fun.
A role-playing game of deaths and ghosts in the world of urban fantasy with the distinct atmosphere of Nordic Noir. And I don't remember what they actually described Nordic Noir as.
Okay. I get a lot of idea. This both intrigues me, but I feel like this feels more alien than a classical fantasy environment to me, because I don't know what Nordic Noir is.
Yeah, I have to. You know what? I didn't do due diligence and look it up. I'm actually going to.
Let's take a look. Well, they made their money and then some by about fivefold. So well done. Apparently, there's a lot of demand for Nordic Noir. Essentially,
okay, here we go. Typically a realistic style with a dark and morally complex mood. And I guess the reason it's called Nordic Noir is because it comes out of Scandinavia.
Okay, I can see that, but how would that be different than, say, North America for playing it? Like, how would it change the entire environment? Because, oddly enough, being in another country might make it a lot more different and more alien than are more classical trope environments, like, say, the West, or swashbucklers, what have you. That I'm going to have to find out more about, because they've officially perked my curiosity.
And for us on this side of the ocean, $11 for the electronic version. U.S.
That's not too bad.
Well, sounds fun, that's for sure. And they've obviously made the 3 stretch goals down, so they're in the second stretch goal where they rip the veil, where they're going to add an adventure, as well as an expansion for supernatural scenarios.
Yeah.
Oh.
So that's, I mean, that's kind of cool. I like the idea. This is a game that I would probably just play once or twice, but I would never run.
Yeah. I can say that's like, you know, but again, there's certain games you want to try once in your life, and this might be one of them for me. Well, you know, just to see what it's like, and then you can say with your own opinion what's whether it's good or not.
Well, if you ever do, let us know.
I will consider that.
This next one is kind of a weird one because I don't understand why they're doing it, but it's Superpowers Unleashed for Savage Worlds, because I'm thinking Savage Worlds has the superpower companion already. But it's a licensed product, which I'm sure is not too... It'd be very interesting to see what their take on doing superpowers in Savage Worlds versus what Pinnacle has done by themselves. And maybe, you know, maybe there's some additions, maybe there's some rule changes that they do for their particular version.
Yeah, they're still trying to make their money here. They're only about halfway to their goals with 16 days to go. They could make it, but ultimately they need to sell the product and show us why we want to purchase it at this point. You're a residential expert here. Is there anything that catches you as far as this is concerned? Like, what is the original system for Supers and Savage Worlds like?
It's okay. I mean, because you got to remember that their original Supers game that they had was Necessary Evil.
Yeah.
Where the concept was that aliens invaded and the only people left were the villains to defeat the aliens that are trying to take over the planet. Which I always thought was a cool concept, but, you know, how would that really work in gameplay?
Well, it makes more sense if you have, like, the equivalent of, say, a Magneto or Doctor Doom, who can, you know, basically is a lesser evil, for lack of a better term. Then you could actually group these people together, or maybe you have some like a heel face turn like the Thunderbolts or something. It'd be doable, but then you'd also have those schmucks who are still running around or say, screw the universe, I just want to take care of my woman or something.
Yeah.
Man, or whatever. Or Gopher, for all I care.
They do have a 14-page preview doc, and I guess they have some example powers listed.
Yeah. So, well, again, in many ways, the super environment...
So actually in here, they have a new version of Superpower System. So they have what they've done is they have their own version of how they are doing superpowers, which is different than what was in the Superpower Companion. So if you didn't like the way the Superpower Companion did superpowers, maybe this might be something to look at.
Yeah. It looks like they have their own kind of setting, too, with the War of the Dead, it looks like. That down below they have add-on hardcovers for, so it looks like graphic novels or, yeah.
Well, War of the Dead. I wonder what that's all about. Is it like a Black Lantern thing or?
I don't know. They just say the add-on War of the Dead hardcovers. It doesn't sound like they're adventures. So, oh, maybe they are. Yeah, it looks like they are actually more their. It's some of their other Savage World products.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, if anybody's listening, feel free to let us know all about this product, and we'll bring up any details in the next podcast.
Yeah. So $10 for the PDF. So that's not too bad, I guess. This next one sounds interesting, but I'm not sure if it would be one that I would ever play. Axion Punk Overdrive.
Wait, I think I've heard of this. Hang on. I'm just reading.
I like the tagline. It's tabletop RPG combining hip hop and classic cyberpunk.
Yeah. Oh, I see what they did. Yeah, I remember hearing this on somebody else's podcast where he goes into a full rant where he's basically trying to make a cyberpunk hip hop environment where there's a lot of these in jokes and so forth. So if that's your genre or mix, I could see you getting a lot of fun out of this sucker.
Yeah.
Again, you'd have to be in the zone. It's almost like what I call the L5R syndrome, where if you don't have the buy-in, there's no point in buying the product.
I think you'd have to have a group set up beforehand, like, okay, we're going to do this, and, you know, have people who are interested in the genre and the setting and the time frame and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. It sounds like a blast, but I don't know if it'd be my cup of tea, per se. Yeah. Whereas, paradoxically, I think I get a bigger kick out of both Cowboy Bebop and Samurai Champloo, which Cowboy Bebop's essentially a space adventure with, you know, jazz backdrop, where Samurai Champloo is a samurai show with rap as a background. So I see what they're trying to do. I appreciate it. I tip my hat to the man. I'm glad he got funded. But I don't know, man. You'd have to sell me on the product in the first place, or even show me a Let's Play.
All right, two more products, and then we're done. First up is Lore of the Gods, which is, I guess, the Pathfinder RPG version of this material.
Okay.
And it's basically, you know, Egyptian, Greek, Mesopotamian, and Norse pantheons.
Yeah. Since deities and demigods, they've been always wanting to start out gods.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where I went with this. At a certain level, I've come to the point where it's like, if I'm going to have a fantasy game world, I'm going to have my own deities. I'll make them.
Yeah.
Well, they're deities, too. I mean, you really need stats for them.
Ultimately, they should be a plot device, not a statted up monster. You know. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if they statted these guys up like that. I can't, you know, without looking at the material, I don't know what's in here.
No. It looks like there's probably a lot of monsters there from mythology, like the Nemean Lion, the Hydra, etc. Or Apophis or something, but I don't know. This is the guy that does the Into the Green thing as well. Okay, that's kind of cool. So, this guy has serious credit as far as his overall quality is concerned. I'll give him full kudos for that.
Yeah, so basically what it just says here, it's mythical artifacts, magic items, along with new spells and domains, and I guess some new templates and prestige classes.
Well, it makes sense, and, you know, like, unfortunately, the bar is kind of high, because I still have my Green Ronin stuff, where I got the stuff for the Testament, if you want to play in the Old Testament. I don't never used it, but I intend to one day. And Green Ronin did some amazing material back in the day when it comes to product like that. And, oh, that's kind of neat. I didn't realize Bastion Press is the one that's doing the Kickstarter. That's kind of cool. I love some of their earlier work, like Arms and Armor and Herbs and Herbalism, which is... It's one of those books that you want to read, but you don't know if you ever want to use. Because he went overboard in herb lore and logic and different items and stuff.
Yep. But I think one of my problems with these kind of books is that... I know that, I think it was Green Ronin who put out an Egyptian theme setting. I want to say it was called Hamunaptra, but I could be wrong on that.
Yep.
And this was back in probably the early 2000s. And I was eager to pick it up. I bought it. It was a box set, actually. And I was really, really disappointed with it because it was just... They just kind of scratched off the serial numbers for a couple of character classes and then slapped that onto kind of a generic, well, now this is all Egyptian setting, and then that was all it was. I felt like the work wasn't put in there to actually make the setting feel like it was you were traveling in mythological Egypt. So that's one thing I sometimes have a problem with these kind of products.
Yeah, like what you're doing with mythology stuff, the bar is kind of high because I'll be blunt, GURPS happened. And if you're ever going to do any sort of historical or even fictional historical campaign, you're going to be compared to the GURPS supplement of the same name. And some of them are really well researched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just my own personal preference. So if you're selling this for the fantasy type campaign, you're going to have to I assume the video will have something there, but you'll need some sort of really serious elevator speech to show your own personal twist. Or some other house rule game like MythEnders, which is a game that Ryan Macklin did, where he basically had it where if you become a myth, you're basically written out of the game. But your job is to end the myths before they start. But paradoxically, by stopping these fictional, you know, these mythological beings, you're becoming one in the process. So kind of a balance there. So, which is spin on this whole concept of gods and deities and stuff. But I don't know. We'll see where it goes.
All right. Final up is this one's. It's interesting, but at the price, no. Which is the Adventurer's Kit. It is basically a carrying case for RPG related stuff.
Well, it's a neat concept.
Yeah, I mean, they reached their goal. They were only asking 5,000. They're at 33,825 at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. The book looks good. I mean, not the book. The box that this is for looks good.
Yeah.
It's just cost.
Yeah, well, it's $140. And I thought $25. Okay, that's not too bad. Oh, wait, that's just for the T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I do like the dividers and stuff. Like, it looks really well designed. And
yep.
It's one of my fetishes, storage here, so it's definitely fulfilling that sucker here.
$195, though.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
They have a few. They have one that's slightly. They have one that's just the external case, none of the dividers or anything. And that's 140.
Yeah, but if you're going to do that, it feels kind of underwhelming when you open the sucker up and you got to basically build your own dividers.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you might as well just be using a plastic container.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than that, it does look good. I'd be hard pressed to spend the money for it, though.
And I'll give them full kudos. They sure as heck give you your color options. That's for sure.
Oh, no. I like the options. I like the colors that they have available. I just don't know if I could justify spending that kind of cash on this.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree. It would be kind of tough to spend that. I mean, and to get the value out of it, you'd have to be traveling a lot with your books and stuff like that.
Yeah, and if you spend $200 on your case, do you really want to travel with it all that much?
That's a good question.
You know, I'm not saying it's not awesome. Like, if you're just taking it to your weekly thing, the new shiny is going to wear off awfully thin for what you paid for it. And if you're doing it all over the place, maybe it'd be an awesome icebreaker if you're going to a con or something. But I don't know.
I mean, obviously, you can replace a lot of books for $200.
Exactly. And unfortunately, the biggest advantage of this sucker has already been kind of replaced. It's called a tablet.
Yeah, or if you have to go back in time, it's called a backpack.
You got her. Oh, good Lord. We all have stories about weight and that stuff.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think that's it for the Kickstarters. Anything else? Oh, you mentioned the bag of holding.
Yep. The bundle of holding has got a couple of really good products right now. I think the one ending the soonest is the Rocket Age bundle. Rocket Age is from, it's the same company who does Shadowrun. I can't, starts with a C. I can't remember who they are off the top of my head, but it's the pulp sci-fi set in the 30s, kind of an alternative 30s. And I think you can get the core books for $7.95. And then if you go for $19, you get the whole kit and caboodle, everything that they released for the system. I already have everything for the system, so I don't need to buy that one. The next one that's ending the next soonest is one that might be of interest to Jeff, is the East Texas University bundle, the Savage Worlds edition. The $9.95 gets you the starter set, and the $21 will get you, I don't know, a handful of extra books. Have you played the East Texas University setting?
No, not the setting, no.
Okay. Does anybody know anything about that setting? I've seen it around a bit, but I've never actually kind of dived into it or really looked at it that closely.
Sorry, man. This is literally the first time I've heard of this thing.
Oh, okay. It's been banging around for like a couple of years now. And then finally, the Vampire, the 20th Anniversary bundle. $14.95 gets you, I think, two or three books, including the Vampire 20th Anniversary edition. And then $25 plus, I think, right now. It's going up fast, so if you want to take advantage of this one, you'll definitely want to get on top of it right away. We'll get you a handful of extra books, including, I think, an adventure and some books on some of their more famous vampires in the vampire universe. So they've got some really diverse and interesting deals on there right now. Usually at a pretty good price, if you need to fill up your PDF collection, this is a great way of doing it.
Yeah. Actually, the one I'm getting a real kick out of is I was clicking around, and apparently there's a bundle holding for Rocket Age.
Yes, that was the first one I mentioned, yep.
Oh, that's right. I guess I'm falling asleep here. Now, that's the one of the three that intrigues me the most, but, you know, I'm kind of a bit of a fan of what I call retro future, you know, or where we actually can get our jetpacks, thank you very much.
Yep, and I have all the books, I have all the print books for that, and I have all the PDFs for it. The system is really strange. You know what? I was thinking of something. I'm thinking of Cosmic Patrol. Rocket Age is by Cubicle 7.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting system because when you take damage, you take it directly off your stats.
Ouch.
So, and your stats form part of your dice pool for success.
Yeah.
So as you get, you know, as you get hit, your strength goes down, or your health your constitution might go down, those kind of things. So it's, you know, I haven't played the system yet. I've read a lot of the material and I really enjoy it. I'd be interested to see how it plays.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at as well here, because the world seems fun. The rules, what little I've been able to see about it, look relatively reasonable, but again, you have to give a good game test before you really, you know, pass judgment.
Yep.
You know, because some books look great in theory until you actually try them out.
But, mm-hmm.
Anywho, well, is there anything else, guys?
No, I think that's it. So if anyone has anything they want to tell us, you can send us info@rpgcircus.com email. You can post something on our Facebook page, our Google Plus page, or even, you know, if you go to our homepage at rpgcircus.com, you can comment on the actual episode when we release it. If you go to our Facebook page or even our homepage, there is a link to the SpeakPipe application to send us a voicemail, because we haven't had any of those. So we'd love to get some of those. And I think that's about it for this week. You guys have any closing comments, or can we just call it a day?
We can call it a day.
Cheers.
All right, then we will call it a day, and we will see everyone in about 2 weeks.
Cheers.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.